My thanks to Trevor Paglen for joining us in hour one to talk about his amazing project. The Last Pictures is the name of the book, and we have links to the website. Check that out. It's a beautiful book, and certainly is thought-provoking. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Trevor. You know, there's an oft-repeated axiom in the scientific world, and that is that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And it often pops up when science is confronted with something that it doesn't really want to investigate. Topics like the ones we cover on this program, UFOs and ETs, for example. Scientists might tell us that they would consider evidence if they were presented with it, but in reality, it's as if mainstream science sort of sticks to what it likes, almost like a religious tenet. And if we think or they think it can't exist, then it doesn't exist, and no amount of evidence will convince them otherwise. You know, when Coast listeners were first to learn a couple of years ago that a study had been undertaken to investigate DNA from purported Bigfoot specimens, there might have been some hope in the paranormal world, among this audience, for example, that an honest study would win the day, that solid evidence would convince science that the Bigfoot legend was worth investigating a little bit further. While I think that there are some brave scientists who would dare to go against the grain, for the most part, I think there is no way in hell that most scientists would give such a topic a fair shake, regardless of what kind of evidence came up. That is my opinion anyway. And as we're about to learn, that is the way it has sort of turned out so far anyway. Hope springs eternal. But by far the most vehement, the nastiest reaction to this aforementioned DNA study has come from those people who think of themselves as Bigfoot researchers, people who have a vested interest in one version or another about what they consider to be the truth about Bigfoot. Those folks have worked themselves into a real tizzy about this DNA study, attacking the study and its principal coordinator with a vengeance most often seen in the UFO community, even though the study results have not yet been made public. It has been relentless. So what is the status of this DNA study? When might we see some actual results? And what do the scientists involved have to say about some of the criticisms and witticisms, the barbs and insults that have been launched in their direction? When we come back, Dr. Melba Ketchum joins us with the Bigfoot Lowdown. Stay with us. Coast to Coast AM returns in just a moment. Dr. Melba Ketchum is the founder of DNA Diagnostics. It was established in 1985, a company and lab that's been a leader in all types of DNA testing, including human and animal forensics. Dr. Ketchum's also established a research program ranging from gene mapping to develop something called Vera SNP, which is a platform for universal genetic evaluation in multiple species of animals. She's developed some other kinds of expertise that we'll get into when the conversation begins, but she is now best known for her participation and leadership in a study of what we are calling Bigfoot DNA. Dr. Ketchum, great to have you on the show again.
Thank you, George. It's very nice to be here.
Let's start this way. I mentioned in the introduction and then earlier in the program as well some of the criticism that's come your way. I think I understand some of it because people are anxious to find out what you've got. They're thinking to themselves, gosh, this is taking so long. When can we see this? Explain to us, for purposes of the rest of our conversation tonight, what the parameters are for our conversation, what we can and cannot get into, and why there are limits on what we can get into.
Well, the reason there's limits is because when you do a scientific study, and this is how it's supposed to go, it's not gone the way I had hoped it would. Preface that. You do your research. Nobody really knows what you're doing, and most of the time, the subject matter, nobody really cares out there. So you quietly just do your research, and when you finish your research, you submit it for publication to a scientific journal. It goes through a peer review. They usually make you make some changes, and then you go back, and they actually publish it, and then they announce to the world, gee, we have this new finding in science. And you know, there's thousands of papers every year, and most people don't even hear about them. And the journals, they obviously want to have the shock value of coming out with something new, so they ask you not to, you know, tell anything about the study, not to divulge what your actual research is or anything until it's said and done. However, having a little bit of a notoriety with the type of subject matter that we were dealing with when it got leaked to the public, the game changed, and it really has more or less become a nightmare.
You felt like you had to come out and say at least something, even though you couldn't say very much, right? You felt that the leaks had sort of changed the fairness and the evaluation of what you were doing.
Oh, absolutely. And I felt that not only did I have to defend myself to an extent, but I was trying to get people to understand that we didn't want the information out there. We wanted to finish our work and then just come out with it like every other scientific study. But that just wasn't to be, considering the jealousy involved and the different things that you had mentioned previously that have come along unexpectedly with this study. I mean, I haven't been a member of the, quote, Bigfoot community. I mean, I'm just a scientist, and we managed to have an interest in this. And, I mean, I didn't look for it. I didn't believe they existed. I didn't want anything to do with this. But it just kind of landed in my lap, and this dust has begun a journey that, you know, I honestly wish I'd never taken.
Well, let's talk about that journey and how it started. Dave Polite, as I mentioned, he's been on the program before, wrote a book, a couple of Bigfoot books called Tribal Bigfoot. And I know he was looking around the country for a lab that might be willing to take this on, and he settled on you. And at that time, to clarify, at that time, you had no real interest in Bigfoot. You'd never done any Bigfoot work. You didn't have any collection of Bigfoot books, right?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, I didn't believe they existed at all. This species identification in the lab, I mean, that's something we've done since, oh, gosh, 95. And, you know, ever so often, once or twice a year, somebody would send us a sample that they alleged was from Bigfoot, and we giggled and tested it, and it usually came out to be a horse or a goat hair or something like that. So, I mean, it was just, you know, it was a service work. We just would do what people would ask us to do, which would be species identify, you know, whatever they were sending in. But none of them ever turned out. I had no interest in it, really. It was just something we did in our lab.
And since then, I mean, you know, obviously we're going to get into what has happened since then. If you had the choice to make over, would you do the same thing again? Would you still do it?
No, not at all. I mean, I wish I had never even heard of the thing, to be absolutely honest.
Let's talk about your credentials. I mentioned them briefly, very briefly, about the DNA diagnostics, the company you run. Tell me more about that, what it does, and then a little bit more about your expertise, because, you know, I've read your entire CV, your resume, and you're not just doing testing on doggies and kitties to find out to help people identify their pets. I mean, you've done some world-class stuff.
Yes, we've been really busy. I mean, we were established in 1985, and for years we did all types of testing. We started out with horses. Horses have always been my expertise, both as a veterinarian and moving on into the lab work. You know, horses have been the thing. We worked on the horse gene map. We were one of the, when gene mapping was very, very embryonic, we actually did linkage mapping in the lab and other types of testing to go. We're one of the founding labs in the horse gene map. I mean, it's online. You can, you know, see that we've done that.
Meaning that you were instrumental in helping to map the whole gene of horses worldwide. Yeah.
Yes, and like I say, there's a website for that. There's a European component. There's a North American component, and, you know, we're listed there. We, you know, actively participated for years in that study.
You've done a couple of other ones, too, dogs and cats?
Yeah, I was chair of the Dog Map Committee for the International Society for Animal Genetics, and I was also a three-time horse. They have different, you know, categories where you have committees that basically establish guidelines for testing animals and gene mapping animals and what have you. And I was a three-time horse chair, a dog map chair, and a committee person for the Dog and Cat Parentage Committee.
I know that you also have been an expert witness, both in civil and criminal trials. Tell me about that.
Oh, yes. Back in 95, whenever we really started doing real heavy testing and we got our first automated sequencer at that time, we started doing criminal cases. And, you know, there's been a wide variety. Most of them have been homicides and major crimes because that's where law enforcement is willing to put forth, you know, whatever it takes to either prove or disprove somebody's innocence.
But I mean, you know, law enforcement at least considers you an expert witness in these areas.
Yeah, that's something we've done, like I say, since 1995.
And you've helped put bad guys away?
Absolutely.
Any case that you want to tell me about before we move on?
I think my favorite case was back in 2004. We had a triple homicide out of Victoria, Texas. And this young man had, he was a very good college student, and he snuck home one morning and stabbed his entire family to death, his father and his mother and his brother. And he stabbed them brutally multiple times. And he, after he did that, he went outside and stabbed the dog 17 times and then went back to college and almost got away with it. They didn't really think him a suspect until somebody in the town said they saw his car in town that morning, they thought. So he was investigated, and actually one of the forensic scientists I know out of the state lab found a spot of blood on one of his tennis shoes, so they went in and took the sample. And when they tested the sample, the little teeny spot came up as his dad's DNA, but they weren't sure they had enough to really get him, so they noticed a peak that denoted animal in that profile, which is something we've actually used to help screen our Bigfoot samples. Whenever they saw that, they called us and asked if we could do the testing on the same little teeny blood spot that was now extracted. We did, and we got a profile that matched the dog also. So they felt fairly confident at that point, but still wanted more. So the next thing they did was, the prosecutor called me and asked if I could identify, you know, if I had any idea if I could identify the difference between human scratches and dog scratches on the guy's arm. I said, well, I would try. So he sent me pictures. And when I was talking to him, I said, really, they do look like dog scratches. I mean, being a veterinarian, I've had my share of dog scratches, and they're a little more elliptical than human. And I asked him, I said, you know, we could get DNA out from under the claws of the dog. I mean, you know, what did you do with the dog's body? And I was informed that he had been buried in a body bag 15 months earlier. And I thought, wow, I said, well, we can probably count that out. I said, he's probably liquefied by now, and there's not going to be any way we can retrieve DNA from this. Well, the next morning I get a call. It's kind of a funny story because one of my classmates, another veterinarian, was actually down in the hole digging up the dog and had lost his breakfast. He wasn't happy with me. And he collected the toenails from the carcass and as well as we had him pluck hair around each stab site because enough force is given when you stab something and you drag the knife that the part of your hand will have contact. And we hoped that maybe there would be some DNA left around the stab wounds also. And we were lucky because the dog had had a postmortem and they had not put the viscera back into the dog, so the dog kind of just molded and dried. And they had buried it very deep also, which kept it a little bit cool. So anyway, long story short, we got in there and we did a protocol that actually one of my co-authors developed the extraction procedures. And also the Armed Forces Laboratory uses this to help identify remains of like Vietnam soldiers that they find in the jungle, maybe a bone or something that they think might have been a U.S. soldier that was missing in action. They'll send the bone to the Armed Forces Lab, and they have this procedure where they amplify little tiny segments of DNA and then put it all back together to get a profile. And that's what we did. It took us, you know, about 5 months on the case, a really long case. And when we were finished, we unambiguously had mitochondrial DNA that was consistent with that of the suspect. And one more little note for the armchair scientists out there. I always ask people on this case, I said, well, you know, the guy allegedly stabbed his mother and his brother and his dad. And, of course, mitochondrial DNA is maternally inherited. So I always ask when I talk to a forensic group about this case, I ask them to say, why was this profile important considering that it was that, you know, he had stabbed his mother and his brother, because they should share the same mitochondrial profile. And I've only had three people answer this correctly. And I will have to say, believe it or not, one of them is a teenager. I couldn't believe it. It's actually a friend of mine, and his teenage daughter answered this correctly. And her name's Cassidy, and I'm going to give a shout-out to Cassidy because she did a great job.
Well, I don't want to dwell too much on your credentials and credibility, but the fact is that that is at the heart of what's going on right now,
right,
is whether, I mean, you've been portrayed as a wacky, loopy lady, and in actuality, you're regarded, pretty highly regarded in a lot of circles, including law enforcement, and until you became a Bigfoot person, and then you became a nutcase.
Yeah, that's just about what happened. That's true. You know, and in answer, the kid was adopted, by the way, for people that are curious. And so that's why it was, and he did plead guilty and is serving life without parole. So end of story on that, and on to Bigfoot.
What does your lab do mostly? What's the work you do day in and day out other than Bigfoot?
Well, we have done a lot of service work where we would do, you know, parentage testing on different species. We've done the forensics. We've done some research, other research, like I said, a horse map, among other things. I mean, just a little bit of everything.
The reason I ask that is because one of the criticisms that has popped up is Melba is wacky because we checked the Better Business Bureau and she got an F from the BBB. And I'm trying to figure out exactly why that means your DNA testing of the Bigfoot samples is bad, but respond to that for a moment.
Well,
let's get that one off the table.
First of all, we have about the same numbers as our major competitor. If they would go check their numbers, the BBB reports, you're always going to have those. We did have a contract that was misrepresented to us that was supposed to reach, you know, like X number of samples before they were able to be tested, because it was not cost efficient unless they did. And we had the agreement with the head of that particular group, and so we were holding off testing, and we didn't have that many, and they didn't tell the people that like I'd ask them to, and so the people were screaming for results. You know, it's just been a couple of bad deals through contracts. It has nothing to do with, you know, the actual testing at all.
Okay, it's not related to the accuracy of the results or anything?
Oh, absolutely not, no. No, not at all.
So when you were approached about this idea of working on the study, what sold you on it? You had to know there were going to be risks to your credibility.
Curiosity killed the cat.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish I hadn't been so curious. I love a good mystery, and, you know, like I say, I should have never done it, but I was very curious, you know, because I had never gotten results like we were getting on these samples. And, you know, then I started reading about it and realized that when we started getting human results on these things right off, and, I mean, we run a forensic lab. We know how to keep something from being contaminated. When it's anything that has substance like hair or tissue, we wash it just, I mean, wash it so hard. We have this little vortex, or this, I mean, it's just thousands of RPMs, and you know, we put it in solution, and we clean it so thoroughly that it'll shake any loose cells or DNA off of the sample. And I mean, you have, when you're a forensic lab, you just don't use contaminated samples. And so, you know, we were in the habit of washing things, and when we washed it and we still got human DNA off of non-human hair, that just was crazy. And, you know, it, of course, and then I read on the internet and was told by, well, Dave Pilates, among others, that, you know, there had been other tests out there done by other laboratories that had come out human on the testing. And this was fascinating to me because I just couldn't understand that. You know, and another submitter, Adrian Erickson, had an Erickson project. He had, you know, one of his samples tested at two different labs. Both the labs got human on it. So, you know, when you have already kind of a set precedent there, and then you get it yourself, and you're going, wow, this just can't be. Could these things actually be out there?
Well, we'll get into that, because you issued a news release in response to some leaks. I want to go over what you're allowed to say that was in that release, because it's enough to shake things up for sure. And that thus we have the response from the Bigfoot community. Dr. Melba Ketchum, who is leading the DNA study, Bigfoot DNA study, is our guest. Stay with us. And in case I have yet to say it, Merry Christmas to you and your families, all you folks out there in coast-to-coast land. We're glad you're spending part of your holiday weekend with us here. Dr. Melba Ketchum heads up a DNA research project aimed at finding out if Bigfoot, the big guy, is really out there, and if so, whether there are any common links with we humans. When we come back, we'll talk about where the study stands right now and what results are available to speak about already in the public arena. Stay with us. Much more Coast to Coast to come. The last time Dr. Melba Ketchum was here on the program, she and Dave Politis, Bigfoot researcher and author, asked the Coast to Coast audience, hey, folks, if you've got a suspected sample, skin or fur or hair or whatever of a possible Bigfoot, send it to us. Melba, did you get any samples as a result of that?
Yes, we did. We had already had a number of samples in, and then we got more when that happened. So, you know, we appreciate the viewers that participated.
As I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, the reason that you're here to talk to us, the reason you felt you had to issue a news release, a press release, is because of leaks from within the study. Talk to me about that in general. I know there was a Russian guy who put something out about your study, and you responded to him, but there have been other leaks along the way, personality conflicts, things of that sort. Speak to me about how difficult it's been to keep a lid on this while you're gathering the information.
Well, it's been nearly impossible because you have well-meaning people involved in the project that have just slipped and said things. You've got people that a lot of people wanted in on the project. They were, you know, obviously interested in the subject and they wanted a part of it. And, you know, some of those people turned out not to be very ethical. And it brought forth some terrible things in the early part of this. And whenever I removed them from the study because they were leaking things, among other issues, they came back with a lot of lies and personal attacks that just weren't true. And of course, the public, like, you know, everybody loves the Inquirer or Globe or those kind of magazines because they're always sensationalizing everything. Well, my life for the last 5 years has been a tabloid. And it's crazy because I've always been a very quiet person that, you know, I love to just have my home time and you know, not a person that seeks out this kind of thing. In fact, I don't like it.
Well, you can say goodbye to anonymity from here on out, I'd say.
That ship has sailed.
Do you feel that the study was infiltrated? You mentioned about a lot of people wanted in on it. Did any of them get in on it and then try to sink the ship after you kicked them out?
Yes, there were two in particular early on, and one of them is now deceased. And you know, he got in the study because at first he was a front man for another researcher. I mean, I didn't know who any of these people were. I mean, you know, I'm coming in blind, and here this man shows up with samples from another person and doesn't tell me they're from, or, you know, doesn't tell me they're from another person. And then the person that actually had the sample shows up, and I find out that he's been alleged to be a known hoaxer. And I'm like, but this is like after the fact, after the samples are already in, and after this person is, oh, just give me something to do. Please, just give me something to do. I'm not healthy. I want something to do. So, I felt bad. And I gave what I called homework, busy work, and none of it would ever make it into the study. The analysis was all wrong, but it gave this person something to do. And, I mean, he was likable enough to talk to, and I just didn't see it coming. And whenever the first leak occurred, and I threw back an NDA that was very strongly written, stronger than what I had, and that was the beginning of the war. And then also, him and another man came forward and wanted me to do a documentary with them. And, you know, I said, I don't have time, and, you know, I'm not really that interested. Well, we'll do all the legwork. Well, you know, they end up forming an LLC and sticking me in and signing themselves up for 2/3 of any proceeds from anything I do. And I said, whoa, I didn't agree to this. I didn't sign anything. And so I was the demon from there on.
Yeah, then you got hammered for, look, this lady's just out to make a name for herself. She's already cut a deal to do a documentary even before the study is done.
Right, and the thing was, it wasn't ready, and I didn't agree to all of this. And then it just, the personal attacks came like crazy. I was throwing people under the bus and, you know, that I was a terrible person. Look, if I was out for fame and fortune, I could have had it years ago because I've turned down double digits worth of news and, I mean, documentaries and, you know, series type things. I just won't participate. I mean, this $10 million bounty crazy thing, I was approached about that. I mean, I don't want any part of that. At this point, I want my study out. And, I mean, in the future, yeah, if the time's right, and, you know, I might do a documentary or something, but that's not my primary goal. My primary goal now is, now that I know they're real, I want people to leave them alone. Don't hunt them. Don't go into their living rooms and make a jerk out of yourself, because they're the type of people like we are. And, you know, I certainly wouldn't want people trying to study me and come in my living room try to find me.
Well, we'll get back. We'll get back to that, and don't jump ahead of ourselves here, because we had a lot of ground to cover before then. I want to talk about the Bigfoot community. Now, you had people that were affiliated with the study, at least in some kind of ways, who went out and started telling stories, and then you have a whole bunch of other people who are on the outside looking in, who think they know what's going on, and they just spread all kinds of stuff. I mean, like I said in the introduction of the show, I thought this was just reserved for UFO community where they stab each other in the back. But wow, the stuff I've read about you is nothing like the person that I've met. Talk to me about the steep learning curve of who the Bigfoot community is, how it's divided into camps, and what kind of lessons you've learned along the way.
Well, the lessons have been very hard indeed, especially for somebody that just, likes their privacy and, you know, doesn't want to fool with a lot of this. I mean, I tried to answer people's questions as much as I could. I tried to be nice to everybody. You know, when people would email, I would always try to give a response. But, I mean, it's just gotten so far out of hand now, and there's so much craziness out there that's just not true that, you know, it's just changed my whole outlook on everything. And most of the criticism at this point is coming from people that felt they had a bona fide dog in the hunt, so to speak. They, some of them are people that believe that they're apes, and of course, they're just going insane because they can't believe that they wouldn't be a straight ape. And, you know, we've disproved conclusively they're not apes. And this is, that camp is really upset. I mean,
right there, you're wiping out about 75% of the Bigfoot books that have ever been written, aren't you?
Yes. And, I mean, the ones that are really, the ones in the know and the ones that are the loudest are that group. And the problem with that is that they're not open to change. And a lot of them aren't, and that they thought they would be the ones to prove it. And it's, I don't want to steal their glory. I didn't care less about that. It's just, but that's how they come across. I mean, and it's even gotten dangerous. I've been threatened. There was a terrible incident that happened at a meeting I was supposed to speak at, to the point that I ended up making a tape for them instead because, it's still under investigation. I can't talk about it, but, people could have gotten killed. And, this is just insane.
Well, I guess potentially there's a lot of money involved. There is certainly money for those who are already in the TV or documentary or book writing business.
Right. And, some of that is, some of these people, they live to go out and hunt these creatures. And, of course, we get this well established, the hunting will stop because you can't go hunting another tribe of people, basically. And, a lot of this chasing and call blasting and, that type of research is counterproductive. And oddly enough, the one thing I've noticed over the years is that most of the people that go out and aggressively pursue them are people that may have seen one run across the road, or they may have, had some kind of experience, but none of them have had real interaction with these creatures. They're all people that are obsessed because they've just either seen one in passing or had something weird happen to them in the woods and got interested in the subject. The people that actually interact with these type of creatures, they keep a very low profile for the most part.
You know, it strikes me that there are millions of people out there who just want to know. You know, maybe they do go out on the weekend and look for tracks or something, that they just honestly want to know. And it's a burning curiosity, as it is now for you, as it is for me, who do not have a dog in the hunt, who they're sitting there and saying, gosh, we can't wait for Dr. Ketchum's DNA results to come out. Those regular people, they're fine. They don't have the sort of vested interest that some of your worst critics have.
Right, that's what it boils down to, exactly. And, you know, the majority of the people are very supportive, and, you know, they're wonderful to deal with, and, you know, I get a lot of support from these people, and, which, you know, after the press release, what has surprised us is even more. I mean, 90% plus of the input to us has been people just saying, oh, thank you so much. Now I can hold my head up and tell people what happened to me, that I saw one and won't be made a fool of. And you know, oh, thank you so much. I wasn't crazy. I really did see what I saw. And people, that, you know, we've had people come forth and tell us stories that they've never told anybody. You know, finally able to clear the air in their mind, and that's very healthy for people. And for that reason, I'm so happy. And that was, you know, that was something that impressed me about Adrian Erickson. He's one of the submitters in the study. I asked him, I said, why are you doing this early on? And he says, I want to vindicate the people that have seen him. Because he had a couple of very up-close encounters, and, you know, that got him really interested from the time he was a small child. So the people, you know, people like that, he wanted them to have an outlet to be vindicated. And it seems like that's truly happening, so he'll be happy about that.
Talk to me about science, and then we'll get into the study itself, where things stand, as far as you can say. But, you know, I would like to believe, I was pretty harsh on science in general earlier, but I'd like to believe that there are scientists out there who'd be open to this, who would love nothing better than to be part of this research and find something as momentous as this potentially is. Can you speak to that, or would you rather just stay away from that, not tick off anybody?
Oh, that's a mixed bag. You know, we actually have done a little peer review on our own to make sure that, you know, our paper was where it needed to be before it went anywhere. And along the way, we've had friends and colleagues to look at it. And, you know, it's like a lot of mainstream scientists just have trouble wrapping their brain around it. I mean, they trust it because they know me and they know the people on my team. But they're just like blown away, kind of.
They just say it can't be. It can't be, therefore it isn't.
That are blown away and say it can be, and then there's yet others that just are downright nasty about it and say, oh, it's just got to be contaminated, which is the one thing we're sure it's not.
I think the nastiest stuff I've seen is, again, from the Bigfoot folks. There was an article I read, and I can't believe that somebody even online would put it on, that says, well, we think Melba maybe was raped by a Bigfoot.
Oh, God, yes. I mean, lies, and more lies, back to the tabloid aspect of this. I mean, I have to just kind of laugh and go on about it. I mean, you know, these people aren't worth suing. They're not worth my time. So I have to just ignore it, and you know, that's the way I should do anyway, because it's the right thing to do, is just, you know, I just let it roll off my back like water off a duck's back and go on with life. I mean, what can you do? It's not true, obviously. That's ridiculous. And so many of that particular blogger, I mean, I you know, from the inside, I mean, there's been almost, you know, everybody seems to think he's right about stuff. He hasn't been. And I just don't want to address it, because, I mean, why should I address somebody who's insulting?
Back to the study itself. Now, the reason we're talking about it now, the reason you're here, is because there was a leak, and a guy in Russia, a Russian scientist, put something out, and you issued a release to respond to him. How did this guy get the information? What did his leak say?
Well, basically, he's part of the study, because he was in on procuring, you know, one of the domestic samples, or a couple of them, actually. And then he also we're working on some Russian samples also. So he had access to the study, and he just got really excited. One of our, you know, people had talked to him about it, and he had access to all the information And even with the NDA in place, he just got excited. And I think he really, there's a little bit of a language barrier there, and I think he just didn't quite understand what was going on, and so he jumped out with it. And rather than let it, you know, the real leak that was real information get, you know, into the tabloid, into things, I decided just we needed to go ahead and address it. And, you know, if it hurts our study, it hurts our study. But, you know, we had to, we couldn't just leave it out there hanging.
So this guy didn't do this in a way to purposely cause you harm. He just got enthusiastic.
Right. That was it. I mean, because he even, you know, wrote some things about, oh, I don't want to wait 50 years for this to come out. Because, I mean, you know, he's worked with this for, you know, 40-something years. And you know, he's an ethical person. But he's seen stuff get put off for 10 and 20 years by the scientific community in his country alone. So he said he didn't want to wait another 50 years for, you know, information to come out, or 25 years, whatever it was. It was a large, long period of time anyway. And so he thought he could get by with doing this. And, well, he did. And it's out there now. But, you know, it's just one of those things you got to deal with. And I can't be mad at him. I mean, because there is that language barrier. And, you know, it is, I mean, it is what it is. You just deal with it.
Do you regret responding to him? Do you wish, hey, I should have just not said anything? Who would even know that this guy put this out?
No, I'm glad I did it, you know, as far as the response, because it would have just gone into all kinds of craziness if I hadn't. It's a legitimate study, and, you know, the people that are vindicated, if, you know, if everything went to heck in a handbasket, we would definitely have helped people that have had experiences that, you know, I mean, that has touched my heart more than anything, is to have people come and say thank you so much.
Well, we got to take a break in about 3 minutes, but let's start on the study. Can you describe where things stand now? I mean, I would assume you still have samples to analyze. You're still doing some of that, but you have written a paper, as confirmed in the release you made.
Well, what we're working on right now is, the thing is in peer review, which, you know, means we can't talk about the actual data. We can talk about some of it that's out there, but, you know, we can't go into great detail. But the flip side is that at this point, so much has been leaked, I almost don't care. It's just, you know, it's been long and hard, and I'm ready to be done with this. And so, you know, we're actually just waiting now. You know, we've been asked for things, and we've furnished them, and so we're just waiting. And that's a painful place to be.
One of the big criticisms is, why is it taking so long? Melba said this, Melba said that. Her predictions about when it might be out have been wrong. Something must be wrong here.
Well, first of all, Melba didn't say a lot of the things that have been out there, but, you know, some things I've said on my own, and you have to understand that this study had to work with something that's never been worked with before. And when you're working with, you don't have any baseline to deal with it, and you get strange combinations of results, it takes a lot longer. You have to go back and rework and retest. And the other thing that I was absolutely sure of pretty early on was that we were going to be facing an uphill road with this. So I felt it was imperative to get other labs to test, and to test blindly. In other words, to not know what they were testing. And, you know, it took time to get all these labs to get their results back to us to confirm what we had done. And then even further, you know, we mentioned the genomes that we've done in the study. And, you know, it doesn't take very long to actually do the sequencing. It takes a few weeks. But when you have novel data that's not been seen before, the alignment takes brutal amounts of time. And even in a known genome, it takes years to analyze a genome. It takes supercomputers. It takes more than anybody could even imagine to do, you know, even what we've done. I mean, we've done it really pretty fast, considering.
Well, we're going to take a break now. When we come back, I'll try to get you to tell me anything I can squeeze out of you about the nature of the study, the kind of information that went in, and the kind of information that's going to be coming out. Dr. Melba Ketchum talking to us about the Bigfoot DNA study underway. Much more to come on Coast to Coast.